If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Colombia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, in Bogota, Colombia, for the Colombia Calling podcast. This is episode 250. Quite a landmark episode for our niche market Colombia podcast in English, as some people say, the English voice in Colombia. Very flattering as well. Just a brief update. Those of you who follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Colombia Calling will know that we were nominated for 4 awards at the Latin Podcasts Awards last week, based out of Alabama, interesting enough, but a whole slew of podcasts from across the region. We were nominated in Society and Culture, English Language Podcast in the Latin field, also Colombian-based podcast and Podcast of the Year. Unfortunately, we did not take any silverware back, but it was a real pleasure and very flattering to have been nominated in 4 categories at the very least. But anyway, without further ado, let's jump into this episode 250, and I'm greatly appreciative of having been contacted by Andrew White, who's an Australian journalist based in Medellin. So, yeah, Colombia's second city, obviously, and, well, Pisces will say it's Colombia's first city, but we know that the weather is always good in Medellin, and it's just a wonderful place to visit and to live. Andrew has been here for 5 years, and he's sort of a health and a technology journalist, or a science journalist, as you say, and there are so many stories coming out of Colombia right now, and, of course, written by Andrew himself. He's been published in Nature magazine. They'll be published shortly in the Daily Telegraph in the UK. He's on Monga Bay, NBC, Sydney Morning Herald. So, you know, we're talking proper editorial content here. Andrew, welcome on Columbia Calling.
Thanks very much for having me.
You're most welcome. No, and thank you for getting in touch. Now, I've been drawn, of course, I've read lots of your pieces, and well, it's an awesome thing and great niche that you've got with this, being a science journalist. You've been here for 5 years. What originally brought you to Colombia to report?
I originally came to Colombia to dance. I am a mad keen salsa dancer, and I had started dancing about nearly 10 years ago now in Australia, because I was working for this startup and didn't have any time, and I just wanted to find something social to do that was a bit physical, and so I started in this little country hall in Australia dancing salsa and once or twice a week, and then, you know, a few years later I moved to a city where they had 3 live Cuban bands a week in Australia, and by the time I had my sort of quarter-life crisis and went to Southeast Asia for a couple of months, as most young Australians are wont to do, I spent most of the time dancing salsa in Hanoi, Cambodia, Ho Chi Minh City, and when I got back, people were like, well, why don't you go to Latin America for the rest of your year off, because, you know, you've danced salsa all through Asia, why not go to Latin America? So I went to Guatemala for 3 months, learned as much Spanish as I could, you know, 5 hours a day for 5 days a week, and got all the basics down and arrived in Colombia ready to dance the night away in Cali, which is one of the world capitals of salsa, and realized that Colombians speak really, really quickly in comparison to Guatemaltecos. So I basically more relied on my salsa skills to communicate when I got here than my Spanish skills, that's for sure.
I really wasn't expecting that response. I have to say, I was expecting, well, you know, the new frontier, Columbia change, et cetera, et cetera. But on the back of your quarter life crisis and traveling in Southeast Asia, you ended up moving due to salsa and swinging hips to Medellin.
Obviously, as happens to a lot of travelers here, they go and travel for a few months in Colombia and then do other parts of Latin America, come back to Colombia and keep coming back, and eventually they meet someone. So my partner's Paisa, and we've been together 4 years now, so when people go, why are you here? Like, it doesn't make any sense why you're here. And then I'm like, my partner's Paisa, and they nod and they smile, and that's the end of the conversation.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? That's it. I was hospitalized in Medellin many, many years ago, and I remember all the people that in the ambulance could talk about. It's like, oh, and do you like the paisas? You know, and there I am with a drip plugged into my... it's like, thank you, Mr. Ambulance Driver. I just want to get to the hospital. But let's get to the crux of this. You've been writing science pieces here, technology pieces for standout publications and so on. Let's talk about the state of, you know, sort of science journalism for Colombia right now. I mean, with, let's say, the peace accord, I mean, and we know it's not 100%, and we know everything's acting out and so on. Colombia's in a tricky situation, but it really has opened up opportunities for you in this field, to write about situations and issues in Colombia. Tell us a little bit about these.
Yeah, so I guess a good place to start is with science in Colombia in general. I don't think a lot of people who live here actually realize that there are 53% of Colombia's landmass is still covered in rainforest, and it's the world's most biodiverse country in terms of bird life. It's in the top 10, I think, of amphibians, reptiles, a lot of different animal species. So it's a very, very biodiverse country, and with any biodiverse country, that means that there's a lot of things going on scientifically, and one reason for that is obviously just to catalog them in the first place, but also to use those new species, for example, to find a unique molecule that might be used for drug design or to combat cancer. That's called biodiscovery, and there's been a lot of that done in other countries, in Australia especially, where they go and find like a fungus or a cone shell, and it turns out that that is an amazing painkiller or an amazing molecule that can stop tumor growth. So those are the sort of potential things. Like, Colombia definitely has a lot of potential in those areas. And one of the great things about the current, it's sort of best of times, worst of times kind of thing, like most things in Colombia. Yeah. And one of the great things about the best of times is that previously, in order to get to some of these places, to actually do the on-the-ground field work in science was impossible because you couldn't really say to a paramilitary group, look, I know that this is the area that you control, but we'd really like to go looking for frogs. that's not something that they were particularly open to. So I have a friend, she's a science journalist, a Colombian now based in Miami, and she has been a science journalist for decades. And when she, in the 80s, wanted to go with scientists into the field, the military would put on a whole operation. So she was going in sort of like a Apocalypse Now-style Huey helicopter fleet that would go to these remote areas, and the government, would be very, very security conscious about that because they were going into these very deep jungle areas. So now you don't need to travel with an entire armored division in order to go and look at frogs or mushrooms. And for example, Kew Gardens, which is a research organization and botanical garden in the UK, did a trip this year for looking at orchids, looking at fungi, like mushrooms, and they found many, many species that are now new to science. And they were only really able to do that because these areas were now no longer militarized. They were no longer active conflict zones.
Amazing, isn't it? I've got the image now of your friend riding in to the jungles with the sound of the, you know, Ride of the Valkyries in the background, you know, and throwing sort of smoke bombs down and so on. But that's
getting out the butterfly nets.
So have you, I mean, this Kew Gardens, I mean, of course I'm familiar with Kew Gardens, incredible place in London there. Were you on a trip with them? Did you get out there?
I spoke to the researchers afterwards. One of the things about being a science journalist here is that sometimes you only hear about these amazing things once the results have been published or after everything's been counted. And so, you know, they have, thanks to this program by the government called Columbia Bio, they have these trips so often, every few months, out into the jungles to collect new biodiversity, and sometimes they're 100% Colombian, sometimes they're international collaborations, but I definitely am keen to get on one of those trips next year, and also to go down to Antarctica at some point, because Colombia has an annual trip down to Antarctica that I'm very keen to go on.
That would be amazing. I mean, that's a proper trip. I mean, you'd have to change your complete wardrobe to get down there from Medellin to Antarctica. But I mean, that would be phenomenal, that kind of journey.
Yeah, and I mean, that's one of the things that I really enjoy about what I do is that it gives you an opportunity to go and do things that 99% of people don't get the chance to do. For example, last year I was able to go and see the Pope and be right up close. Didn't get to speak to him, but I was very, very close, and you sort of, you know, get other opportunities where I went to Switzerland once and went into the Large Hadron Collider right down inside this massive tunnel buried in the Jurassic part of the Alps, and it's just one of those things where you're sitting there going, how did my life lead me down this path where I'm in the Large Hadron Collider or on the high seas or wherever I happen to end up.
You have definitely some stories to tell. I think it'd be great to sit down over a beer and just chew the fat one of these days. If you ever come to Bogota or fancy visiting Mompox, just let me know, because there's just so many things. The Hadron Collider, I mean, I don't know about these things, but I know of these things. It'd be so interesting. But, that's it, isn't it? The twists and turns of life and, of course, journalism. And taking the plunge and moving out to Colombia to report on science stories. But, of course, it's not always about the science stories, is it? I mean, you, as an Australian journalist based out here, you've also been, of course, your email account must have been buzzing when the young lady, Cassandra Sainsbury, was jailed for trying to smuggle out however much cocaine in headphones, was it, some months ago?
So that was an interesting one, because I got a really strange tweet that just said, can we talk to you about the Colombian justice system? And that was all it said, and it was from a broadcaster in Australia, and I'm just sort of sitting there going, what is going on? Like, just turning it in my mind, and I started googling and then making calls and then figured out what was going on. But it was just so insane that out of the blue, an Australian little radio station Adelaide, her hometown, was asking me about the Colombian justice system. And it's really interesting the way that, science journalism is one of those things where you're trying to tell people things that they need to know, but they don't necessarily want to know. Anyone who's read anything about climate science will know that, science journalists and scientists have been trying for decades to try and educate the public about what's going on there, for example. But it's so much easier to get a click about something about Meghan Markle, for example. Mm. So it's there's this tension in journalism between the things that are in the public interest, that is the things that people need to know in an informed democracy, and the things that people are interested in, which is the clickbait, the things that really drive readership. So, I've done both kinds of stories, and I think in particular with this Cassandra Sainsbury tale, she had been detained in Dorado Airport with almost 6 kilos of cocaine, which is above the level needed to inflict the maximum sentence of 30 years. She went into her trial. The Australian media were there. They had flown people from LA, from London, all the way from Australia. And it was very strange to suddenly be one Australian amongst many in this little courtroom. And but the thing was, I've been here. I speak Spanish. I know the. I had a friend run me through the penal code of exactly, you know, what she's being charged with and what the penalties were and everything. And I had just gotten a smartphone after 3 years of just having my little burner phone, and was able to file all the things directly from the cab on the way back to the airport to get back to Medellin. And I think that's one of the things that I think there's an advantage of having people based in a place, being freelancers or being correspondents, is that they know the place, they know the land. Of the land, and they can write better stories for it. So I'd like to think that I was able to use this sort of supermarket tabloid kind of story to write stories about the global trend of increase in international mules and using women as mules, being able to talk about the different justice reform in Colombia, for example, and basically pivoting off something that people want to click on with some stuff that they want to know, a bit of sugar to make the medicine go down, if you will.
No, I appreciate that. As a journalist myself, I appreciate that you didn't take it just as a, as your front page tabloid thing, a pretty blonde girl set up sort of thing. If you were, obviously you were able to actually, as you say, pivot off and actually address more serious topics, then it's of more importance. And I don't want to dwell so much on this Cassandra Sainsbury story particularly, and that's not what we're really talking about, but very interesting the way you approach it as we finish this first segment of the show. So let's just clarify for my readers: she's been sent to prison. Will she be repatriated to spend time in an Australian jail? What's going on as we finish this segment?
Yeah, so basically she's in El Buen Pastor women's prison there in Bogota, and she's expected to remain there for at least another 6 months, and then she has the possibility of having home arrest in Bogota. There's some logistical issues there because she'd have to live in Bogota, but it's really up to the judge and the justice system. So for the moment, she was convicted a year ago. She's been in prison since, and that's pretty much where she'll stay until the next round of appeals and parole.
Okay, don't get involved in this. I don't know if it was entrapment. I don't know if she was fully involved. I don't know. I do not know the ins and outs of the story. I mean, that's the long and short of it. But we're talking to Andrew White, and he's a science journalist based out of Medellin, originally from Australia. Fascinating talking to him on this episode 250 of the Columbia Calling podcast. We're going to take a short break and be back with Andrew talking further about some of the stories that he's been chasing and has published here in Colombia, because really there's so much going on here at the moment. It's a very exciting place to be based in. So we'll take a moment to say thank you to Andrew, but we'll be right back. Listeners, don't go away. We'll be addressing further stories here in Colombia in just 1 minute. So thank you for listening. Yeah. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And on this episode 250, we are talking to Andrew White, who's in Medellin, so the other side of the mountains from us here. He's a science journalist from Australia, but he's now a Paisa, or an honorary Paisa. He's based there. He's writing some really interesting stories, things about which I know nothing. Here in Colombia. And I wanted to pick your brain a little bit, Andrew. I mean, we've talked about some of the stories, some of the things you're hoping to go on. But I've read Michael Jacobs' book, The Robber of Memories, about the Magdalena River. And of course, it's a personal account of his travel along the Magdalena River. And he ends up going to the town in, I believe it's in Antioquia, where there's people who suffer from juvenile Alzheimer's. And of course, it was a very personal voyage for this great author. Everyone should read his books, but rest in peace. Because both of his parents passed away having suffered from Alzheimer's. But you, being a science journalist, presumably know a great deal more about this topic, the Alzheimer's town or region. It is in Antioquia, right?
Yeah. To be honest, I haven't done a story on this particular one, and one of the reasons is that zona is still a bit caliente, not the safest in the world to go, being a gringo asking a lot of questions. So I haven't been able to go up there, but I can give you the sort of potted plant version of what the story is there. And basically, one of the interesting things about modern medicine is that we can use genetics to find particular causes of particular diseases. So if you have a population that is more susceptible to something, for example, if everyone in this town has early Alzheimer's or shows the symptoms earlier, there are genetic markers that you can, you take some DNA samples from those people, and then you try and figure out, okay, what do all these people have in common? So if there are certain regions of the genome that all demonstrate that all the people that present with symptoms all have this particular region of the genome, then they can say, okay, well, let's start investigating these in the lab. Let's look at maybe if we were able to fix this region or have a drug that targets this region, then we would be able to get closer to some sort of treatment. So these things always take decades. It's not a thing where you can sort of go, oh, yeah, that's the gene for that. Let's have a drug. Like, this is the work of decades. But there have been some Colombian and international scientists who have been working on this for years. It's one of those things where it's something unique to Colombia. There's nowhere else in the world that has this particular cluster. And essentially, it's a way for scientists to be able to study this and get clues to something that might have global benefits.
Incredible. And I mean, do we know why this is happening? Is it isolation? Could it have been exacerbated because of the conflict? I mean, people not being able to, increase the gene base. I don't know. I don't know a lot about this.
Yes, essentially, whenever you have a very small, isolated community, the gene pool isn't as diverse as it could be. So that leads to certain traits being retained because you're not getting any fresh blood in from other places. So in big cities, that's not a particular concern because you have people from all over. Then having kids and those kids have that genetic diversity. But when you are in these smaller towns, the influx of new genetic material, so to speak, isn't very common. So what happens is very similar to what happens in the Galapagos Islands with the tortoises and the finches, is that you get these very particular set of genes caused by that isolation and separates them out from the rest of the world.
And okay, so perfectly. And we talked off record, but now on record. I mean, fascinating, this one. The science story, these isolated towns. Is it something called, is this related to the X syndrome?
Yeah, Fragile X. I think this is actually a separate town. I'd have to check that.
Okay.
I think that's a separate town. But yeah, I mean, these are interesting laboratories for scientists to do the work, because these things, you can't recreate these things in the lab. You can't get a population that just has these things in the lab. So sometimes you just need to find them out in the wilderness and then try and get some get the benefit that you can in terms of the science. Scientific knowledge, and then continue it in the lab. And it's interesting that you know, you're talking about human health and those kinds of benefits. When I came to Columbia, I wasn't sure what kind of science stories I would be telling. I have a background I have a degree in molecular cell biology, which is basically all the inner workings of the cells that make up our bodies. But I also know that in all around the world in science journals, and your two go-tos in terms of content that people will want to buy is space and dinosaurs. Mm-hmm. And so I thought when I came here that I would be doing a lot of dinosaur stories, because I didn't think that there was any space applications here. Mm-hmm. And you know, the majority of the stories that I've done have ended up being about agriculture, coffee, and how space technology is helping Colombia to really move forward, particularly in the agricultural field.
Fascinating, isn't it? It's fascinating. So this X syndrome and this Alzheimer's and both in Antioquia. So you basically have based yourself in Medellin. It seems like ground zero for your work. I mean, fantastic to be so centrally located, despite, you know, some of the difficulties because of zonas calientes or zonas rojas and so on. This when you said dinosaurs and space, it made me think of La Guajira a little bit, and a story that came up some years ago about the huge boa constrictor, I think it was, or the mega snake fossil that they found, I guess, near to El Cerrejón, the big open pit coal mine around there. Do you remember this?
Yeah, so Colombia has some really interesting fossils, and the I haven't written this story either, but there's this guy, I think it's in Villaleda.
Yeah.
Or Vigilita, I think it was Vigilita. And basically he and his brother were raised in the States and came back to Colombia and had just basically invented paleontology here in this country, or reinvented it rather. And so there are quite a few paleontologists working in Colombia. And the interesting thing about Colombia is, for most of its geological history, it's been sort of this wide, warm bay. So there's a lot of more aquatic creatures than there are terrestrial creatures or creatures that live on the land. Mm. So you've got these massive turtles, you've got these massive snakes, really interesting fish and things like that. So not too many giant dinosaurs like Argentina does. Argentina definitely is the bad lands of Latin America. They have the lion's share of the great dinosaurs. And if you ever get to Patagonia, I would encourage anyone to go to a really good dinosaur museum that they have down there. Basically the kinds of things that Colombia has produced have been more of the creepy crawly scaly kind than the raptors or the big plant-eating dinosaurs.
Fantastic. So tell us a little bit about that. I mean, you were touching earlier on this sort of like NASA space and coffee. So tell us a bit about this, the research that goes into protecting coffee here. I believe that's one of your big stories, isn't it?
Yeah, so I did a story about the NASA of coffee, and this is the moniker given to CeniCafe, which is CeniCafe, and basically the National Coffee Growers Association of Colombia. They basically had a breeding program for coffee plants. They wanted to make sure that they could have the best coffee plants possible, and that was about 100 years ago. And since then, they've been able to build this out near Chinchina, outside of Manizales. They have this massive research institute with, I think, now over 80 different PhDs and postgrad researchers working on everything to do with coffee. So it might be soil scientists looking at what the interactions are there with the soil. Coffee is grown on so many different kinds of soil here in Colombia, looking at the pests, or plagas as they're known here, looking at all the different fungi and bugs that attack coffee, those kinds of things. So they're really looking at this from a very commercial point of view, that they want the best price for the coffee, which means a healthy coffee product. It means resistant to diseases. But they have a big challenge because it takes about 20, 25 years to create a new variety of coffee. So when you consider that there are pests that might come over to Colombia any day from Africa or from Asia, it's really quite scary to think that it takes so long to get a new variety out the door and into farmers, out to farmers, because coffee is a very slow growing plant, and you have to figure out, you can't, it's not like with frijol or beans, you can't just cross them in 90 days and then have your new variety. You've actually got to plant them out there and wait for 3 years for them to give their first harvest and things like that.
But what makes me, you know, what fills me with a degree of hope and let's say confidence, is that these entities are conscious of the challenges and the risks. I mean, it seems very advanced in a country which, without talking ill of my adopted homeland, seems to allow things to happen and then say, oh, this happened, you know, this is, you know, what do we do now? It seems to me like, you know, that this is real forward planning.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about science is that it takes a lot of time, so you can't really improvise. And it's interesting to, having lived here, you know, the attitude to time is different depending on whether you're in a professional or personal mode. If I'm planning something in my social life here, you don't really know what you're doing until 20 minutes after it started. But you can't really conduct science that way. And so there are scientists in and science is global, so you have to hold yourself to the global standard. So, you know, they are the world's largest and I believe oldest coffee research institute in the world. They particularly focus on Arabica, the variety that Colombia is so famous for. And so in terms of what they are focused on, it's very much maintaining Colombia's position in the world, because Colombia can't compete on volume. There was a time maybe 100 years ago when they could, but now Vietnam and Brazil are the powerhouses of volume production of coffee. So now it's more a fact of, how do we get coffee that tastes better, that smells better, that is resistant to disease, that will yield more for each plant that we plant? Because in Colombia, you have these tiny, tiny parcels of land, and I've been out to a few, and they might be even less than a hectare. Yeah, but they, the family will, their whole, there's 500,000 coffee growers in Colombia, and they all rely on getting that coffee income. So the way that Sene Cafe tries to help out is to get them to, they have an extension service where they take agronomic engineers out into the countryside every single week and check in with the farmers and try and get them the best weather data, the best soil science, all those kinds of things, so that these farmers can be informed about the best way to cultivate the coffee, because the future is being able to produce higher quality coffee at good volumes, because Colombia is never going to be able to produce the same amount of coffee as those other countries I mentioned.
Yeah, it's very true. Very true indeed. Well, I mean, really, before we move on, what's one of the biggest challenges to the coffee? Is it called coffee rust?
Yeah, there's a few different coffee pests. There's three main ones that I always get them mixed up because they have names in Spanish and then they have names, scientific names, and I can never keep straight which is which. But basically you have the broca, which I believe is the bug. There's the coffee rust, and then there's another bug. I think it's the coffee borer beetle that gets into the berry, the cherry of the coffee. So although, fortunately, the latest variety out of Seni Cafe is resistant to most of those. So they're fine with that, but there was a time not too long ago, about 5 years ago, where there was an attack by coffee rust, and they weren't quite ready. They were just in time, basically, and that it still devastated large parts of the coffee region and reduced production for many years, but we're back up to those previous levels, and that's because of the work of Seni Cafe with these new varieties.
Amazing, amazing. So tell us what's on your agenda for the coming weeks. I mean, what stories can we expect to read from you? You know, what exciting travels do you have planned?
So next week I'm off to Macau on the border with Venezuela. There's a UK charity that's doing a visit there, and I'm hoping to visit a hospital there and find out what the different health issues are there. Some health statistics that I have from the government about Venezuelans seeking medical assistance in Colombia has been about the top causes of people going to see a doctor. You would think it would be something like dysentery or malaria, and those things are there, but the number one reason that Venezuelans are seeking medical attention as of earlier this year was domestic violence, injuries caused by domestic violence, which really startled me because I wasn't really prepared for that. I was doing a story on measles for the Telegraph and about how in March a child had arrived in Medellin from Venezuela, bringing measles into the country, where it has been eradicated. But fortunately, Colombia has a very good vaccination system set up, and people were not infected because they were vaccinated. So, one of the stories that I'm hoping to tell from that is about how Venezuelans... there's been a little bit of fear-mongering in Colombia about Venezuelans coming here and what they might be bringing with them. And at the end of the day, Venezuela's health program hasn't been very robust in recent years for obvious reasons. But for the most part, Colombia's health system is fairly robust, and for the most part, there's not going to be an epidemic of disease from like there is in Brazil. In Brazil's border areas, the vaccination rates are not great for things like measles, and they're having problems. So there are silver linings to this after all.
Yeah, it's one of these issues. I did see a piece, I think it's in the Wall Street Journal by Juan Forero, about the health situation of Venezuelans coming across. It's you've got a country where basically your institutions are collapsed. And so on. But in Colombia, there is screening, and of course, there are a lot of people coming through and so on. But as you say, it's a robust system here. There was, and there will be, and there is scaremongering, but not on the level of, and I hate bringing it up, but not on the level of Fox News, reporting the other day that the migrant caravan coming up through Central America might be bringing unknown diseases to the U.S.
Yeah, the only thing I've seen on that level has been an opinion piece the other day that was sort of intimating that HIV rates might be going up because of Venezuelan sex workers. And there was research to back that up, but essentially I talked to HIV researchers here, and they were basically saying, look, the increase in HIV is cultural for Colombians. It's not it's going up across the board for every demographic, but particularly young people in Colombia anyway. So any increase that's coming from Venezuelans would be part of that, and probably not a very big part. And I was a bit shocked to read something about, saying that Venezuelans might be bringing HIV to this country, but talking to researchers, it's more about Colombians aren't getting great sex ed anyway. They're not, they don't know, I think 36% don't know, of people under 30 don't know how to prevent HIV, the spread of HIV, don't know anything about it. So that's probably more of a public health issue than the Venezuelans are.
Yeah, definitely. Well, nice to clear that up. As we wind this down, a few minutes left, your work as a science journalist, your work in technology and so on, it's taken you around some really fascinating stuff. I want to touch on this final note here. And have you had any opportunity to report or do stories on some of these, sort of, let's say, traditional indigenous medicines here?
I haven't actually. One of the things that I haven't been able to do as much as I'd like is to go into areas that have just opened up and being able to talk to these people. There is actually a lot of interest internationally about ayahuasca and those kinds of things, about traditional medicines. And to be honest, they're very fraught articles to write and very hard to write, because the scientists are very firm that on what works and what doesn't, and the practitioners of traditional medicine are the same. So it's hard to find an objective middle ground where you can sort of make sure that the public is getting the information that they need, and that's a challenge all over the world. One other thing I will mention is that I am part of an organization here, which is essentially the Colombian Science Journalists Association, or ACPC in Spanish, and basically it's a group of dozens of journalists working here in Colombia who are trying to really get as much science out there as possible in this country and in the right way. And there are a few people that I really admire for the work that they've been able to do in getting that science out there as well, because it's very easy to sort of focus on the one guy who writes in English, but there are a lot of other people that are doing very good work in getting science out there to the Colombian public.
Very good. I like that deferring and some humility there. Very nice to hear it here. But listen, if some of my listeners are interested in seeing your articles, you have a website. Tell us the address. It will be on Facebook and Twitter.
It's probably easier to find me on Twitter. The easiest way is at Ligaze. So it's LIGAZE, which is a very bad science pun that I came up with 10 years ago. LIGAZE. And basically my tagline is looking at things and putting them together, because a ligase with an S in cell biology is this little molecule that puts DNA together, and gaze with a Z is about looking at things. So I've seen what I do is looking at things and putting them together, and as every journalist, I have this addiction to puns that just doesn't really benefit anyone.
A definite inside joke there for the molecular specialist.
Yeah, for all those molecular biologists / pun fans out
there. We're really narrowing down the niche attraction of this episode. But listen, let me take this moment to say thank you so much to Andrew White there in Medellin on this episode 250 of of the Columbia Calling podcast. It's been a real pleasure talking to you and hearing your tales about Columbia, and really quite technical but very digestible take on science in Columbia.
All right, great.
All right. So thank you so much for being on the show. This has been episode 250 of the Columbia Calling podcast, a landmark episode for us. We didn't win any silverware at the Latin Podcast Awards, but onwards and upwards for 2019. Thank you, all of you who listen week in, week out. We've had some really strong episodes of late. And yes, if you think of anyone who might want to be on the show or has something to talk about, Columbia, of course, related, get in touch with Columbia Calling at Gmail, Columbia Calling on Twitter and on Facebook. So thank you again. We'll be back next week. I know we've got a couple of people in the pipeline, so there will be interviews for next week. As I say, onwards and upwards. This is me, Richard McColl, signing off for today. Bye-bye.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.